there is an enabler that is missing. And that's why all these big industries that operate in the middle of nowhere without connectivity, I believe that if you enable connectivity, you're going to enable them to gather data, understand what they're doing, change for the best, and help humanity.
You're listening to The Data Point of View. A podcast for anyone interested in using machine learning and consumer data to achieve business objectives. In each episode, members of the Mobile Wallet team are joined by industry leaders and influencers to discuss different ways data and technology can improve predictive modeling, feature engineering, and data enrichment. Let's jump in.
Thank you for listening today. I'm Lori Hood, CMO at Mobile Wallet, and this is Data Point of View. Data Point of View is a podcast for anyone interested in using machine learning and consumer data to achieve business objectives. Joining me for this episode is Flavia Tata Nardini. Flavia is co-founder and CEO of Fleet Space Technologies. Fleet is an agile space company connecting the Internet of Things around the world using a massive fleet of small, low-cost satellites. Prior to founding Fleet, Flavia spent her career at a variety of space-related companies and government entities. Flavia, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Lori, for having me.
So I'd like to start talking a bit about your background and the path that led to your current role. Then it would be great to move on to Fleet and how you and your team are using data to drive change, and then close the discussion with your thoughts about the future of satellites and how you see them transforming our day-to-day lives. So if that's okay with you, let's jump right in.
Absolutely.
So I'm really excited to be able to do this podcast with you because you are a rocket scientist, a real live rocket scientist, and your career choices and your education have been very consistent with this interest and focused on space. So let's start really by talking about your longtime interest with both your undergraduate and graduate degrees being in a related field and kind of sort of how did all of this come to pass?
You're so right. And you know, you describe it very, very well. This is a long lasting passion of mine. We started when I was a younger. And somehow I managed to keep it moving. You know, when everyone is, you see a lot of kids and a lot of young children that love space and they want to be in space, but it's a passion that usually goes away, doesn't it? You know, when they turn, you know, 10 or 11 or even earlier, there is not a lot of rockets or space movies anymore. But for me, it was really something that I care about and I wanted to keep working on. It wasn't easy to understand what would be the path for me to enter into this because it was a real love, I have to say. It started with a lot of stars and a lot of tech and a lot of space and movies. It just kept growing. When I finished high school, I started math, a lot of math and scientific subjects at school. And then I started to go into aerospace engineering, space engineering. I got a big family with five and some of them are engineers and they told me, you know, I should do engineers. I think I wanted to be an astronomer. I don't think I had any idea what was the difference whatsoever between an astronomer and an engineer. But I studied aerospace engineering and then space, master in space. And the love kept growing. The love for first airplanes, then rockets, then particular engines. So the more I went through university, the more specialized in little rockets and everything that went to space. Not sure really how I kept going. You know, I remember sometimes in university in which it was hard, the studies, the, a lot of exams. Now, if I think about it, I'm like, wow. But that's it. And then, you know, when I graduated, and I think I've always been a good student, not a very diligent student, you know, a bit of a rebel student type of girl. Not really being at all the lessons and not really taking all the notes, but efficient in a study, I guess. So I really got away with really good grades, like maximum grades. So turned out that I was good at studying.
Well,
that's how it started.
So when you came out of university, talk about some of your early jobs, because you bring sort of this entrepreneurship to the role as well as this deep background in the field. So talk about some of how kind of the early jobs you had shaped your career and sort of got you to this point?
It is very interesting what you just said, because if I look back at my career and where I started working, there was not a lot of entrepreneurship really related to it. It was really, I was just used to, hey, I'm going to find a job in an organization and keep moving there. I moved from Italy to the Netherlands in my last year of school. I worked at European Space Agency, and then I found a job in the Netherlands in a big organization. They were all big organizations, you know, as a young engineer, then just simply doing engineering work, then becoming good at that and becoming a system engineer and becoming good at that and a project manager. So it just kept going, you know, every year I was like, okay, and then you can do this and do that. And I was good, but I was still working in big corporate, working on advanced space technology. So advanced, like new ideas. I think that's sometimes underestimate my exposure to that. When I started working at TNO in the Netherlands, I was in this group that was working in advanced concepts. So the good things about advanced concepts that we were sitting around the table and think, what's next? Who needs what and why? And I was also one of most talented person in the company, guess what? So I was in all these leadership courses, probably underestimate everything that I've learned there. And I was working on this Mars mission. It was amazing for a little girl, for a young girl. But now that you made me reflect on it, I think that exposure to a lot of advanced technology. So not simply doing what we were supposed to do, but thinking about the future, it kind of initiated kind of thinking mind in me about, hey, if we had to build something from scratch to change the world, what would that be? And I actually experienced something interesting in those years. The frustration of not being able to bring a project to completion when you work in a big company. You know, you come out with these amazing futuristic ideas. Maybe you get some money to do them, but they just die there. You know, most of them, no one pushed them through. And I think it's, for me, it's a good reflection point, because it created a little bit of thinking in me and say, what if we could bring all these concepts to change the world, really, how that will look like. So, and that was my exercise up to 28 years old.
So interesting talking about, you know, the opportunity to really see sort of all of these possibilities, that you had said frustration around working at a big company, not really creating, being able to complete projects. So let's sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about Fleet. How you came up with that idea, and how does it fill what you see as this existing market need?
So after this career that we discussed, I moved to Australia. That it was a big personal jump. So it was not really driven by work. That jump, it was the initiation of building a startup, because I really wanted to keep working in space. I think at this point in time, you understand, it was my passion. So I didn't want to stop. But Australia at the time, that was probably 9 years ago, didn't have a space agency. There were not a lot of companies working in space. So probably entrepreneurship was the only way. I was a bit stuck in a corner. Was not a choice, really. It came to me with the idea of you know, keep working in space, and keep doing what I was trying to do. That was a fantastic opportunity. When my co-founder told me we can build a startup in space because I would like to work in space, he is a serial entrepreneur and started his career with software entrepreneurship. And he said, you know, if we bring our minds together, we can make this happen. At the beginning, I just saw it as an opportunity to keep working in space. But then suddenly I realized there was an opportunity to make one of those big change happen. One of those big change that I've always been exposed to without bringing to life. When you love a topic, finding, you know, like space, it is a weird way of tackle entrepreneurship, because some people tackle entrepreneurship because they see a problem. And most of the time that's really brilliant, because they see a problem and they want to fix it. What I could see is an opportunity. I could see space is changing. Space is incredible. In the past 10 years, we have seen at that time, I was able to see the barrier to entry into space going down. Entrepreneurs building companies that were not government. Technologies allowing you to build small satellites to change businesses on Earth. So I saw an opportunity. And I was discussing, we met my co-founder and telling him, hey, surely we are at the beginning of something big in the space industry. I love space. You love space. We can find business model that makes sense. Because these small satellites, that was my passion. They were really, and they are really changing how we mm-hmm. use space technologies. So we started looking into the topic. We started looking into what people need. What is the big problem? Australia is a big country, incredible and beautiful, but gave us exposure to the lack of connectivity. It gave us exposure to what it means that, you know, just 2% of a continent is actually connected to any form of internet and the rest is unconnected. It was probably the best place to build a connectivity company, really. Because we realized, cool. You know, we really realized that where industries hinging are, the industry with big growth, you know, mining industries, energy industries, solar farms, hydro companies, in yeah. the middle of nowhere, because this is where our critical infrastructures are. Hinging on growth needed to grow, needed to develop, needed to implement IoT and AI and all these amazing technologies, automate really, without connectivity. And, you know, connectivity is the soul of growth, not just for humankind, but also for industries. You know, if you look at all the industrial revolution, the last one gave us the computers, and the computers have changed the way we work and operate. So that exposure to this lack of connectivity, I think it was important for us to understand that incumbent satellites are big, huge, expensive. And they cost $1,000 per megabyte to connect. So they're really a service for an elite in the world, just for the people that can pay for. So it's not, was not yet technologies for everyone. And this is what every entrepreneur realized. Can we bring a very complex technology to everyone? Can we bring the supercomputer to an iPhone that everyone has? That's, I think, it's super fascinating, where you can give access to data, to information to everyone, not just to the big governments or the big companies that can pay for. So we decided, that was our goal.
Oh, cool. So you've really figured out a way to kind of, I'm going to say make this scale, but scale much more broadly and almost bring it to the masses. I mean, you've said two great things that are so quotable, which, you know, connectivity is the soul of growth. And you're so passionate. And then, you know, seeing an opportunity, not just a problem. So just great conversation. Talk a bit, if you can, around how kind of data and artificial intelligence and some of these things come into play with just the complexity of what you're doing and how you're implementing it.
Exactly. So if you think about a satellite constellation, right? That's what we're building. So an infrastructure in space. It can be just a data pipe. So, you know, bringing in data information from one point to the other, going through space. And that's the basic, right? Can you have a data infrastructure that allows you to connect at reasonable cost and globally? Because at the end of the day, towers and telcos, they cover 2% on Earth, 90% of Earth is disconnected. So it kind of makes sense that 90% of the rest of the world needs this data pipeline to send data from one point to the other, right? So the basic idea was, can we create an infrastructure that is lower cost because of several changing technologies? You know, you can be smaller satellites, you can 3D print satellites, you can have amazing technologies that allows you to have small satellites everywhere around Earth. Kind of a, you know, not a, as I always say, not a big bird, but a lot of bees, you know.
Yes.
they create, you know, this infrastructure in the sky. So once you have this infrastructure in the sky, a constellation of satellites around Earth is really 500 kilometers far from the surface, okay? So mm-hmm. you can send data from one point to the other for sure. But how complex data? So let's go back to this kind of customers that we're talking about. We're talking about mining, energy. Yep. These customers in the past 5 years, they've been under a lot of pressure to monitor and understand the way they operate. We're going through a massive mm-hmm. revolution in our industry, you know, driven by renewable energies, driven by eVTOLs, EV, all this incredible technologies.
Climate change, all underpinned
by climate change. Yeah. It is unfortunately, and actually fortunately, unavoidable now that we need to fix Earth. It is not an easy place to be, but the awareness is much higher. And for me, it was always, okay, we now have these heavy industries that are the base of our humankind, you know, give us water, give us material. Think about the mining industry that is it's always an industry under a lot of spotlight, because surely is one of the industries I didn't see. It's not like was intentive to save our planet. Now they actually have to give humanity critical minerals like copper, lithium, cobalt, and so forth to help us transition into the energy future. So how weird is that? So one of the industry that caused the most of the problem, now they need to change the way they operate to actually help. So all these industry are under a lot of transformation. And for them, transformation is driven by data. Okay, I need to have more critical resources. I need to find more copper, more lithium. Okay, I need to create a solar farm, or I need to move energies from one part to the other. And all this infrastructure has always been in the middle of nowhere. So zero connectivity, zero data awareness. So they always been operate simply with people in a car and, you know, connect the pole from point A to point B and just operate it really in an old way without understanding the impact of what they do, without optimizing. And they are now under a lot of pressure to show that what they do is good for Earth, is good for humankind growth. And they need data. They need to understand, okay, we are looking for critical minerals. Where are they? How are we going to get them without drilling Earth? Okay, we need to have more efficiency of solar panels. How does that work? You know, like, because their insight in data has always been very lacking. So I love this moment in which you got, I mean, love and not love it. I'm not happy that we got to a point in which climate change is so big that we need to make a change, but I'm happy to be part of the change, you know?
Yeah.
So there is this push to change the way industry operates, and it's data driven. Of course, that will need to change machineries and infrastructure to be more friendly with the environment. But that change is driven by knowing what problems are they causing. Okay, we're talking about carbon footprint. How do you do that? You measure it. How do you measure it? With data, with devices, with sensors, with analytics. But how can you have this data if you don't have connectivity? So, there is an enabler that is missing. And that's why all these big industries that operate in the middle of nowhere without connectivity, I believe that if you enable connectivity, you're going to enable them to gather data, understand what they're doing, change for the best, and help humanity. So this is in my brain how this works.
So you're providing the technology that's almost democratizing the access to this, because you're able to do it at a lower cost. You're able to bring it to all of these different industries, again, who've been operating in a somewhat disconnected way. Yeah. But I'm sure they're able to collect this data, but you're the one who helps them move it from point A to point B.
And we're trying to push it even further. So we are trying not just to provide the pipe to move it to A to B, but also give the chance to create the analytics in the platform. So using space, not just as a pipe, but as a platform of data analytics, that I think is the next level, is the internet in the sky, right?
Yeah.
That's what we are trying to do. A lot of people say, you know, the cloud is the cloud, but really the cloud is not in the sky, even if it's got its cloud beautiful name. But satellites are really up there. So it's not just moving data to point A to point B. We're pushing even further. Can we give analytics? Can we give, you know, we're a big believer in edge computing. So edge computing is the capability of process data in the, you know, if you gather sensors, data in the field, process data there, process data in the satellite. So when it actually gets to the end user, it's not a stream of information, but it's an action. So, you know, this monitoring system give you action. So, you know, this month, we have just announced our service called Exosphere. And Exosphere is an end-to-end service for the mining exploration industry to actually map Earth underground, up to 1.4 kilometers underground, to look for critical minerals. And for us, was a way to use satellite in a weird way, you know, from the stars to look underneath ground so that mining companies can find critical minerals without having to drill everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And with this service also provides analytics. So in the pipe, we have analytics and we got machine learning and AI because we are looking at Earth from the top. But this is a lot of data. So in this infrastructure, and this is the fascinating thing, that infrastructure of the future are not just point A to point B. Infrastructure of the future is software. So even if I launch satellites, you know, if probably 70% of my engineers are software people, that people will not think, you know, that will think that it's all about hardware launching satellites. But what we wanted to do is create an infrastructure that is not simply a tower with, you know, with an antenna, but it's smart. So it can give you the right data. So it's a lot going on.
Yeah. So talk about, I mean, this is incredibly ambitious and transformational. Started a company to do it. Talk about some of the challenges that you've had along this path and what are some of the things you've overcome?
So, well, long list of challenges, but you know, let's focus on one interesting one. At the beginning, we thought, and it was a challenge to build a company like this outside Silicon Valley. You know, if you look at the past 15 years, there's been an enormous amount of investment in space startup in the Valley. I mean, first and all Elon. But if despite the great growth of Elon, there are a lot of other startups that have done really, really well. But if you look at it, the success of the startup was be like exits, IPOs, PACs. It's just been happening in the past couple of years. So it took slightly longer than a software startup. So space is not as easy as software. You still have to go on a rocket. So we have seen investment in the Valley actually having returns just now. So you can imagine, you know, how new this feels, right?
Yes.
And if you are in Australia, so on the other side of the planet, and you have to access that, you know, incredible amount of capital, because bear in mind, it's hard to bootstrap a space company. Like, bootstrap a space company, it's really hard, you know? So you need to count on VC money and capital and support. So every startup in the world struggle or has a challenge into capital raise. My partner my business partner always make this joke in which he says, you know, I led this software startup, it was really, really hard. And then I'm like, how hard can it be to raise money for a space startup? And he's like, it turns out to be really hard, you know, because it's lower. But so that was the first challenge. You need to convince the market in Australia, in US, no matter what, that to be patient with you in the process the first 5 years to demonstrate that you can do this. The way we approach it, I think, was really good. It was really step by step. To try to create MVP. So MVP is a concept in the software industry, you know?
Yeah.
You launch a beta software MVP and it's not perfect. Now you try to do that in space, you know? You launch a satellite, doesn't have to be perfect. Now we launch the other one, doesn't have to be perfect. So you go through this long process just to learn. And if you got the right investors, they understand. So historically, if you want to build a constellation of satellites, you know, you raise $200 million or $500 million. Yeah. You launch it, then you go bankrupt, you know, and then you try to sell it, you go bankrupt again. That is a very, very disturbing process in a sense. So we wanted to disrupt that. So we launched satellites that are not perfect, but we learn and we keep moving. So that was the challenge.
Almost like an agile, I mean, it's really that sort of agile, bringing agile software.
That is hard to bring it into space, you know, because you're like, you raise 5 million, launch a couple of satellites. Are they fully functional, connecting every customers around the world? No, but they give you enough information to move to the next generation. So we have launched 6 satellites. It's going to be 10 or 12 at the end of this year. And now in year 6 of this company, we are going to start mass manufacturing them and launching 50 a year. So it took time, but we are here. So that was the first challenge, you know. And that really helps you with the second challenge. How can you get to revenue with a space startup without having to wait 6 years? And that really helps by doing things in steps and being very close to our potential customers. Like, I'm talking a lot about mining, that is the main industry in Australia and around the world, but all HQ are here. So being based in a hugely not disconnected place with a lot of customers helped. The other challenge, I think, are not less or more complex than every startup owners. You know, it's growth, it's hiring, it's people. The big challenge also that it was created, it's been an ecosystem that is pushed by an amazing leader, that is Elon, that is absolutely an incredible entrepreneur. And also, so he's bringing the ecosystem with him, but also really does, he's got a heavy presence in the ecosystem, right? So you need to build a business that is, it sits around or is different for what it's building. Because, you know, when we started this company, I'm like, it's not that I don't want to compete with Elon. I'm okay with that. But, you know, if there is something that we can do that he cannot do or he will not do because of technologies, that's where I want to be. It's building something around Amazon or, you know, so that's the complexity of having an incredible leader that attracts most of the capital. So how do you actually build something very smart that makes a lot of money in such an ecosystem is a challenge.
Well, and he brings a lot of attention, which, you know, there's that adage, any PR is good PR. So it certainly probably provides a lot of lift and
so much.
And he's shown what you can do. So that makes a lot of this other innovation plausible.
Agree.
Now, I know that you've opened, you're coming to the United States and you're going to be opening an office in Houston. So how did you decide Houston versus Silicon Valley?
We actually do have salespeople in both of the states, okay. And we will have more. Houston, so my thinking process was always trying to get office that is closer to your customers. And if you think about critical infrastructure and heavy industry, there's a lot in Texas, but we are very flexible lately. So we hire, you know, even before COVID, people work from home everywhere. Now we've got people in Canada. But, you know, Houston, NASA is there. Customers are there. It's beautiful, you know.
Yeah, you know? No, that's fantastic. So before we close, And as we were preparing for this call, you know, you, and again, this is the most quotable pot. You've got more good things you have said in this podcast, I think, than all my other ones combined. But you use the terminology around, you know, bringing the conversation down to earth. And, you know, I can remember a time where it was bold to say that telephone numbers would be associated with people, not places, with like the advent of mobile phones. And when you talk about, you know, what you're doing and sort of bringing the internet into the sky, you know, give us some insight on the things you see happening, you know, over the next, I don't know, 2, 3, 5, 10 years, and how you really see what you're doing being transformational kind of for just everyday life.
Yep. So this phase where we are in is, of course, serving industrial IoT. That it is massive and it's an industrial transformation, but doesn't touch yet every single person or a child, you know. It does touch in an indirect way, but what I do believe, and you know, we already had this conversation before, and I tell everyone, is that because of this change in access and availability of space technology, I think every operator and every person in this world that is currently working on internet from space, that, you know, not a lot, but you know, you can count them probably two ends. We have a responsibility to understand in the next 10 years can have a major impact on everyone. So my dream is really, I mean, look at this, look at the iPhone or a phone or whatever it is. I think if I ask you, what's the biggest limitation of your phone, really? You can do everything with this nowadays. You can do everything. But if you're a person that travel, or if you're a person that travel a lot, or go hiking, or whatever it is, you know, we all know that, again, 5G towers covers 2% of our planet. 2% of our planet.
That's not much, yeah.
That is not much, you know. So really, I hope that these all operators that are working internet from space, starting with industrial IoT, starting with broadband, or starting whatever they want to start, we all have the goal that in 10 years, I really hope less than that, I'm going to have an iPhone. I think it's happening already in the coming years, that connects to space, connect to 5G, 4G, 6G when I am in a environment where this is available, and that connects automatically to space when I'm not in 4G, 5G area. That's what we're working on. This is what we're working on, yep, all of us. And this is going to be transformative, you know, because I think we do not understand first for safety of humankind, availability of connectivity in every side of the world. How I'm a travel a lot, you know, and I like to visit places, and I like to go. I live in Adelaide, in Australia. If I travel 1.5 hours outside the city, yeah, it's done. I'm off grid, and you know, and it's a difficult thought because I like being off grid. You know, it's not that I don't like being off grid. I think off grid is incredible for humans. You know, we all love it. we all love going to that beach house or that mountain house when there is no connectivity, and the first 24 hours is very stressful. But suddenly you're like, love my life. You know.
Yeah.
So it's the weird.
Just relax.
Yeah, just rest. It's a weird balance between not having connectivity sometimes, but also, what's the opportunity for the rest of the world if we all have connectivity everywhere we are? I mean, we can always be diligent on how we use connectivity. We can always switch off the phone if we go to our beach house. But I really hope that the universe can help us and help all these operators to allow phones to talk to space everywhere we are in the world.
Well, and it does. It was again, with the advent of mobile phone technology, places that couldn't have landlines all of a sudden had cell towers, but there are still places that don't have access to cell towers.
Many.
And that connectivity is just sort of the soul of people connecting and being able to be connected. So I think it's a cool thing. This was just so exciting and such a treat to be able to talk to you. And, you know, I want to thank you for joining us, sharing your insights, sharing all your great, great kind of quotable terms and the interesting things that you're working on, because what you're doing will be truly transformational. And I think people will listen to this in a couple of years from now, go, oh, that's what she was talking about. This is really happening. So it's really, really exciting. And again, I want to thank you again for joining us. To our listeners, I want to thank you for your time today. And please join us for another episode of Data Point of View, brought to you by Mobile Walla.
Thanks, Laurie.
Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thank you for checking out this episode of Data Point of View. This show is brought to you by Mobile Walla. Mobile Walla provides consumer intelligence solutions that help data and marketing professionals better understand, model, and predict consumer behavior so they can acquire and retain their best customers. If you enjoyed what you learned in this episode, make sure to follow Data Point of View wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, or visit mobilewalla.com/podcast to get immediate access to all of the latest episodes. The Data Point of View.